Coming up next on WVOX, licensed insurance agent and Medicare specialist Mark Brownstein hosts his monthly educational segment, Medicare Mark on the Air. Tune in for guidance, special guest interviews, and valuable information on all things Medicare.
Good afternoon, WVOX listeners. It's Mark Brownstein here again with you on this Monday. I hope everyone had a pleasant weekend. It's always wonderful to be here and to, again, have a wonderful guest with me. I have Dr. Gerda Maisel with me, and just a quick little pitch on what we do at Emerald Medicare. We support, really, over 1,500 clients in the world of Medicare, answering their questions each and every day, trying to help them make sure they understand the plan they're on and the options they have going forward. Don't hesitate to call 845-358-1220. Again, I have Dr. Gerda Maisel here. Welcome, Gerda.
Hey, good morning, or good afternoon, I should say.
Good afternoon. It's nice to have you here. And we know each other through an organization called Orion, and I've heard you speak so many times recently, and you have so much to share, and so I want to sort of get right to it. And, you know, we were just talking before we got on the air about one's background and what how one got to where one is. And so I love sort of the story that you have about sort of, you know, your parents immigrating and then what you sort of faced as a child getting into this profession. So give us a little bit of background on you, and then we'll get into some details on what you do currently.
Sure. Well, thanks, Mark, and it's a real pleasure to be here. So my background is a little unusual. My mom is English. My dad is South African, and they were both finishing their studies in England, got married, and decided to come to America because my father, as a young PhD physicist, could make three times the amount of money in America than he could in England. So they came to America in 1956, happily newly married. Within a couple of years, my mom had her first child, my older brother, Simon. Unfortunately, when my mom was pregnant, she had German measles. And for anybody who remembers that time, German measles and pregnancy does not mix well. And my older brother was born with congenital rubella syndrome. Well, back in the 50s and early 60s, all they knew was the child was not developing well. And, you know, he was vision impaired, hearing impaired, cognitively impaired. And my poor mother was blamed because back then, whether it was autism or developmental disabilities of any kind, they used to say, oh, well, you know, maybe there's something wrong with the mother. But eventually they did figure out what was going on. And Simon was at home with us. And I remember him very well as a small child. He was my big brother. And frankly, I didn't think anything about it. Then my mother got pregnant with my younger brother, who is 6 years younger than me, and they had to send Simon away. And so Simon was institutionalized, and the institutions for people with impairments were not very good back then. I still flash back to visiting Simon whenever I smell sewage. And so for me, looking back, the decision to become a physician and ultimately a physical medicine and rehabilitation physician really track back to those young experiences with my mom, visiting Simon, seeing him drugged with Thorazine to keep him quiet, and my mom trying so, so hard to advocate for my brother.
So this led to you being a physician?
Yeah, I think so. Because I wanted to, that there was that drive to help people, to make a difference, because I knew that things could be better. The doctors, some tried, some didn't. Some were engaged, some weren't. And I knew there had to be a better way, and I wanted to do that. And I've always been motivated to make things better for people.
So if this led to you being a physician, the area of expertise that you first focused in on, was what area?
It's called physical medicine and rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. It's a small field. There's only about 14,000 of us in the country. When you compare to internists and family practitioners together, about 450,000. Mm-hmm. So many people don't know about us, but you'll see a physical medicine and rehabilitation physician, also called physiatrist, in some hospitals. You'll see us in acute rehab centers and sometimes in outpatient or pain centers.
So, you know, that kind of work is certainly a part of area that acute rehab, and you spoke of it last week, is so there's a difference between acute rehab and some of the other types of rehab. And I was fascinated by the insights that you provided. So what are some of the differences once someone leaves the hospital, sort of the layers of care that people can get and what they can expect?
So when people leave the hospital, there are a number of options. They can go to acute rehab if they qualify. Acute rehab is also known as IRF, or IRF, which stands for inpatient rehab facility. Or they can go to subacute, which is typically in a nursing home, hopefully in a specific unit of a nursing home. And then, of course, they can go home. There's also another level called LTAC for long-term acute care. Most people go to subacute. And there is a lot of confusion and overlap between what happens in an acute rehab and a subacute rehab. Acute rehab is considered hospital level, and you need to benefit from and tolerate 3 hours or more of care, of therapy care a day. So it's a combination of PT, OT, and speech. And it's a little bit of a catch-22 sometimes, because a person coming from the hospital may be too sick to be able to benefit from that much rehabilitation care. The catch-22 about it is that the expertise with people trained in neuro care, people trained in spinal cord injury, head injury, therapists, nurses, doctors, all of that is in the acute rehab. Subacute rehab is intended for a longer, less intense stay. Under Medicare, you can stay up to 100 days in a subacute rehab, but you don't have the daily visit of a physician. You have more of a rounding, often nurse practitioner, who is available if you have something really significant going on. It's fundamentally less intense. It's a different environment.
So, again, that's a key component of what you do, because if someone is coming out of a hospital scenario, it seems to me that they may not know which direction they're going to be placed in. They don't necessarily know the level of care that they're likely to get. And the hospital is really dictating the next set of steps?
Well, the hospital, which is paid on a case rate, meaning they get the same amount of money whether you're there 3 days or 10 days. That case rate means the hospital, if they're going to have any chance of not losing money on you and making a margin, has a very strong incentive to turn over the beds. Sort of like a restaurant that seats a lot of people, in order to make money off of any one table, they need to be able to get several customers in there. And so hospitals are very driven to discharge you at the right time. And so often people encounter a lot of pressure to leave the hospital. And they're often handed a list. Well, here's a list of places. And what people need to know is that you can absolutely look around. You do have an ability within a reasonable, meaning a day or two time frame, to choose which facility. And you also have the right to ask, why is this level of care being suggested and what are my other options?
So if they have that option to discuss the options, how much do they have to advocate if their loved one isn't getting the kind of care that they want or can't handle the care that's being offered?
Well, I think it's about understanding. Mm. So acute rehab is not necessarily better rehab for any one individual circumstance, because if you go to acute rehab but you can't tolerate it, Within a week, you're going to be out of there, and that can be incredibly disruptive. Usually, the level of care is recommended by a physical therapist who has seen the person in the hospital. And so if you're not sure about the level of care that was recommended, you can often ask if you can speak to the therapist, or the case manager may explain what the therapist had to say.
So again, as you moved forward in your career, you had some executive positions before we get to what you're doing today. So what were some of the roles that you had, some of the important roles that you had at different facilities locally?
Well, I'm one of these doctors that actually likes a good meeting where something gets done. Most doctors hate meetings. But I always liked attending a meeting that might influence the future. So I got pulled into administration early and often, and for about 10, 12 years, I was what's known as C-suite level, so chief medical officer, chief transformation officer. My last gig, I was a medical group president, working inside of health systems, usually about a 500-person medical practice.
That's quite the responsibility, and so what were some of the greatest successes that you had in that position with the longevity that you did have?
Well, I did work in a couple of different places, but some of the things that are wonderful to do is when you can put in a new program, when you can improve quality, when you can take have quality data that shows that a certain type of thing isn't going well. So, for example, diabetes care, and now you put in place a program that both involves the doctors and supports the doctors in the way that the care is delivered, and help people actually, across the board, lower their A1C. So that's a small example. We, over the course of my career, have opened facilities in a couple of different places, and it's just fun to be able to design an outpatient setting from the ground up, so that some of the mistakes of the past, like making people wait in long lines only to find out they're in the wrong line, you can fix, and making things more about the patient and the family than about the staff and the doctors in the design.
You do sound like an administrative person.
I switched.
That can truly handle a difficult meeting with different personalities. You seem very level-headed and ability to sort of handle the complexities. And so you changed sort of your interests over time into a private practice. So how did that transition go? What was the timing of it? And tell us a little bit about the work you do now.
Well, so when the pandemic started, I had just taken a new role down in Florida as president of a medical group. And we talked about the fun parts of administration, but there are some things that aren't so fun. There's always politics. There's always cutting the budget. Inside of healthcare, it can be hard to grow at times. When things get tight financially, they want leaders to cut the budget. And during the pandemic, I think she was 90 at the time. My mom's now 92, so maybe she was 89 at the time. During the pandemic, there I was in Florida. My mom was very isolated up in New York. And I realized, even though I was in a relatively new job, it was same stuff, different place. And I thought, do I really want to be cutting another budget? Do I really want to be disciplining another doctor with bad social skills who has a point but maybe doesn't express it correctly? No, I want to help people. I went into this to help people, not just administer budgets. So I decided it was enough. I'd proven myself to myself and my ambitions, and I felt like I really wanted to get back to helping people. But I knew that I had this unusual knowledge both around clinical work in terms of recovery, administrative oversight in terms of being comfortable looking at what other physicians were doing and comfortable broadly with medicine, and then this really unusual skill set of understanding the economic drivers behind all the different levels of care and all that behavior that patients and families see from the healthcare system that, of course, makes no sense to them. But I understand why somebody is doing that. I understand why that case manager at the hospital is wanting you to make a decision and is pressuring you. It has to do with the way the hospitals are paid. So I decided I was going to start this business doing medical navigation. At the time, I thought I was so cool and unique. I didn't know that there were other people doing this kind of work. Well, flash forward, it's now been almost 2.5 years, and it turns out there are other people doing this kind of work. It's called patient advocacy. I'm now a board-certified patient advocate. Unfortunately, there are relatively few doctors doing this work, although I suspect you're going to see more physicians becoming medical navigators going forward. It's incredibly needed.
So you speak sometimes of, and I spoke this morning when I introduced the fact that you were coming on the air as a medical Sherpa, and they tried to have me explain what that component was, and it's really about bringing people to a way of advocacy, but also leading them along the way to a solution.
Absolutely right. That's very well said. I sometimes have a really hard time explaining what I do because the actual content of the work is different with every client. Sometimes it's somebody in the hospital whose loved one's been in there for a long time, and they're frustrated, they're not sure if their loved one's getting the right care, and they want someone to help them have better communication with those doctors and explain to them what's going on and take the time. Sometimes it's someone whose parent has 12 doctors in the community and the doctors are giving conflicting advice and they want someone to translate, to coordinate, to advise them around their choices and help them ask the right questions in that 5 minutes that they have with the doctor and everything in between.
So we have more time, but how do people get a hold of you?
Oh, well, my website is mymdadvisor.com. My email, I will tell you my email over the air, is GM for my initials, Gerda Maisel. So my email is GM@mymdadvisor.com.
And a phone number?
My phone is 845-316-0175.
So in the experience you have in working with all these physicians and all these facilities, you know, my perspective is people mostly do the best they can. They're limited by the financial side, the budget side. You know, profitability is always a very tight component within hospital care.
Yes.
And so the way in which you can support people is to really guide them carefully, patiently to again, not just a better solution, but understanding of what they need to do next and how you can help them in a way that explains to the doctor and to the patient and to the family what's going on and what's needed.
That's right. So it's part of its medical translation. Mm. When I first started, I thought most of what I was going to do was explain medical terms. It turns out that a lot of what I do when it comes to that medical communication is explain what I call the subtext. There is a lot of subtext that even very smart people don't understand in communicating with their doctor. I'll give you a quick example of that, which is if a doctor calls you at 1 o'clock in the morning and says, "What's your mom's code status?" They're not just inquiring as to whether or not she wants to be do not resuscitated. What they're saying is, "Your mother might stop breathing and her heart might stop soon. And I need to know whether or not we're going to call a code and pound on her chest and do all of those things." But they may not say that. They may simply say, "Oh, checking on what your mom's preferences are in terms of her code status." So there's a lot of subtext that happens. And so part of what I do with the communication is explain to people what wasn't said, but what the doctor was implying.
So how do people find you? What are the kinds of sources of research that people have to go through in order to find a patient advocate like you?
Well, I think people know somebody who knows me is the most common way that it happens. I don't advertise. Sometimes people find me through an internet search when they're looking for help. I'm not sure what terms they put in. I can't say that I'm like the best with SEO optimization, but I think they might look for advocate, or they might look for frustrated with medical care, or some terms like that.
So for the stories that you have that are worth sharing here, what's one that sort of rings a great example for sort of a family in a situation where you sort of, well, one of the things I did want to mention was sort of the issue around having too many medications. And I see it in the work that I do in Medicare, as you called it, polypharmacy.
Yes.
Can you explain a little bit more of that? Because I think that is somewhat of an issue that I see, and I'm sure you see more often than I do.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Polypharmacy is incredibly common, which basically what happens is we get older. You go to one doctor who prescribes a medicine, maybe two. You get another condition, you go to another one. And people are astonished to know that while doctors might know about the side effects of their particular medicine that they're prescribing, they often have very little knowledge about interactions. And sometimes not only do you run into interactions with the more medicines that you end up taking, but you end up with cumulative side effects. The classic example is a person who takes a sleeping pill, gets narcotics. Maybe they hurt, maybe they have a problem, they get some narcotics and a muscle relaxant, and then they end up falling and breaking a hip because the side effects from the muscle relaxant, the narcotic, the sleeping pill, and maybe their anti-anxiety medicine or some alcohol are all in the same profile, and the person becomes dizzy and loses their balance and breaks a hip. That's an easy example of a polypharmacy problem. And the reality is, and it's been studied, that you're at risk with five or more medications, and it's only five, and many people are taking way over five, of an 80% chance of some form of an adverse drug event. We call it an ADE. An adverse drug event is either a side effect or a drug interaction. The two drugs acting against each other, can either thing can be an adverse drug event. It may be small, but at five drugs, you're at an 80% chance of having a problem with it. And so it's something I do for so many of my clients. I had one client on over 30 medications. And when I looked at it, he was taking three forms of vitamin D, which he didn't know. And I said, you've got to go see your doctor and get your vitamin D level measured, because vitamin D is not one of those medicines that you just get rid of like vitamin C. It's fat. Vitamin D is fat soluble. And sure enough, his vitamin D level was too high.
So for folks that might be listening who are thinking to themselves, if I don't figure out where these drugs interact poorly, I'm at risk. Who else can they ask if they don't find someone like you? You're saying the doctors aren't necessarily looking at all of the interactions.
That's correct. Well, a great place to start with that are two sources. They can talk to a primary care doctor and specifically go in for a visit to review all their medication. The doctor may or may not know about all the drug interactions, but the doctor, primary care, should be able to speak to, should this drug be continued? You know, perhaps it was started 20 years ago. Do I still need it? And a pharmacist. Pharmacists are very well trained. They know a ton about medications. Pharmacists can be underutilized resources, in my opinion. And you can talk to a pharmacist and say, listen, I'm on all these drugs. Is there a way to check for drug interactions?
Well, that I think is fascinating. And again, in the world I'm involved in with Medicare, you know, the anxiety around medications, the cost of medications in this country really put people at risk of not being able to afford them.
Yep.
They're not all generic. Sometimes they can't use the generic. They have to use the brand name medications for whatever reason. And yes, they can get an exception within the world of Medicare to possibly have it priced the same. We try to help them advocate for themselves or through the insurance company or with the help of the doctor's medical notes. But this, to me, seems like a really important issue. So now that you're in this new career model, are you finding the meaning of this work as you had hoped?
Oh, absolutely. It is so much more meaningful to help a family or an individual develop peace of mind because now they understand what's going on. Their communication with their individual physicians is so much better. And they just feel better. And I love bringing that peace of mind to people and helping them sort through things. I'm a natural problem solver, and I just enjoy that so much. It's way better than cutting another budget.
So the doctors that you're working with or the administrative staff that you're working with, clearly they look at you as a collaborator, but clearly there's some rub of possible, you want them to do one thing and they are inclined to do another. How do you sort of find your way through that when, of course, everyone has their own needs to accomplish different goals?
Well, first of all, I don't view myself as that expert. I can get, I'm an idea generator with experience, but that doctor's going to have known that patient for a very long time or even just a short time, but they're going to have a deeper expertise than I'm going to have. So you've got to go in the door recognizing that you're not the expert when you do the kind of work that I'm doing, but rather the person to ask the question. And what I found is that most doctors like to think through cases. And if you ask the question in the right way, I don't go in and say, you ought to stop drug X, Y, and Z, but rather I say, I give them a little medical context, like so-and-so has now been on drug X for 10 years. They have no symptoms of disease. Why? What are your thoughts, doctor, on how long this medication should be continued? And they'll know. They'll be able to say, you know, maybe this is one we can get rid of. Or they may say, yeah, no, this is a lifelong drug. Okay, great. Question asked and answered.
So we have 1 minute left. Please give everyone your contact information. You have been a tremendous guest. Please share with everyone how they get a hold of you.
So thanks. The best way is to reach out to me on my email, which is G like Gerda, M like Maisel, at mymdadvisor.com.
Phone number?
845-316-0175.
This is Mark Brownstein with Dr. Gerda Maisel. Mark from Emerald Medicare, it's so wonderful to have you here, Gerda. It is an honor and a pleasure to know that this experience and expertise is available in the marketplace. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Mark.